Hello and welcome to Nancy Graham, the Space Ranger. This is going to be chapter 26, but before we get stuck in, I'd like to mention another show called Madison on the Air. And the reason I mention it, well, it's twofold. The first is that they're going to run a 1 minute ad for this show during their Christmas episode, which is going to be Miracle on 34th Street, airing on the 1st of December. And I'd highly recommend checking that show out, if nothing else, for the just excellent voice acting that goes on during the show. It's really the gold standard for this sort of drama. And the other reason I mention it is because the star of that show has also taken part in an Irish science fiction production earlier in the year with the Ireland's top stand-up comic John Cleary, and the two of them have a bit of banter in a mock radio show. It's well worth checking out if you get a chance. But anyway, I'd just like to say thanks to the crew on that show, because it's very kind of them to give this Nancy Goodaim a run at the big time. And to my mind, that is the big time. That's the gold standard of this kind of stuff. Anyway, a hen is a daw is a tree, and away we go. The thing about tunnelling underground purgatorial labyrinths is that there's not much to discuss, other than the mechanics of tunnelling and mealtimes. Swen news that someone had developed a novel way of distributing breakfast, and that a large fat extraterrestrial was creating an army of noobs, passed out from canteen RB-78, the news spread quickly. In fact, it took mere seconds to spread throughout the labyrinth, which, if it was anywhere other than the labyrinth of Chontagul, would have been a remarkable act of information distribution. The upshot of the news was that almost every noob in the labyrinth began heading towards canteen RB-78 to see what was happening. Nancy found herself walking in the opposite direction to the curious noobs. She had decided that Chapter 25 was of little or no use in helping her rescue her commander, or finding a way back to Earth, and decided to head well away from it, and leave Bip, Martina and the Sheriff to their newly acquired self-imposed subterranean circumstances. She had left canteen RB-78 and headed in the opposite direction of the airflow along the large clay torchlit tunnel outside. This brought her past a large crowd of approaching curious noobs. The urge to be first in a crowd of onlookers, which can be distracting at the best of times, was overwhelming for the curious canteen RB-78 bound noobs. Not one of them acknowledged the presence of a crossbow-equipped extraterrestrial walking in the opposite direction. Nancy passed through the advancing crowds of distractedly curious noobs. They gradually thinned into a few slow, straggling older noobs. Nancy took advantage of this to make a closer inspection of her surroundings. What she noticed was flame torches sent into the walls at regular intervals, a musty smell, and tightly compacted clay walls and ceiling. She pulled one of the torches from the wall. The smoke was rising from the flame. It seemed to vanish into the solid ceiling. Nancy held the torch above her head to see how this was happening.
"A noob must never dig up," cautioned a voice nearby.
The owner of the voice was a very elderly, frail-looking, pickaxe-wielding male noob. He was shaking the index finger of his right hand over and back as he spoke. Nancy lowered the torch.
"Why is that?" asked Nancy. "Who knows? Not me, anyway. But it's the only thing us noobs have to remember."
"And what if you forget?"
"I never have. And probably never will."
"Aren't you ever curious to see what's up there?"
"Ah, I used to be, long ago. Not anymore, though. Not since they started doing spaghetti bolognese in the canteen. Now I'm happy enough just to dig. Although, I heard there's no need for that anymore, what with the noob army and everything. My name's Noob 11988. What's your number?"
"Nancy."
"Noob Nancy?"
"No, Mission Specialist Nancy McGinley from the European Space Agency on planet Earth."
"Right. Do you mind if I just call you Nancy?"
"No," replied Nancy. Nancy replaced the wooden flaming torch into the metal holster that had been holding it to the wall. She then patted the clay wall and looked up. It would be difficult and probably dangerous to hack into the roof of the tunnel. "The air must be circulating from somewhere," she muttered. "There must be a way up out of here."
"Up and out of the labyrinth of Chontagul? I doubt it. Not possible. Although, the stairs might be worth trying."
"There are stairs?"
"Not really stairs. More like a windy, windy passageway. But they do go up. So, you know, they might count as stairs."
"What? Are you telling me anyone could just walk up out of the labyrinth at any time?"
"I don't know. Probably."
"Why hasn't anyone tried?"
"Ah, everyone probably forgot. The life of a labyrinth digging noob might be boring, but it's busy. At least I forgot anyway. Plus, nobody has ever brought it up. Well, until now."
"How could everyone forget? How could you forget something like that?"
I had a lot of things to remember.
I thought you had only one thing to remember.
Yeah, but it's an important thing. And quality is always more difficult than quantity. Anyway, I don't think that entrance is far. I think.
The entrance was not far, but it took time to get there. Noob 11,988 was a slow and doddery sort of noob. And those characteristics were expressed in the way he moved.
Here it is, I think.
The here it is was a much smaller gap in the tunnel wall than the one that had been the entrance to Canteen RB78. Much smaller and rougher, and very dark on the inside. Noob 11,988 shuffled in and upwards. Nancy grabbed another of the torches and followed behind the elderly Jupiterian. The path went round and round, and up and up, and round and up and round. Eventually, a tiny crack of light appeared in front of them.
I think I might leave my pickaxe down. It's slowing me.
Give it to me. We might need it. Nancy stopped moving, dropped the flaming torch, took hold of the pickaxe, turned back to face the light, and continued her slow walk upwards. The path went round and round and up and up and round and up and up and round. The crack of light got bigger, and bracing air hit them, along with smells. The smells of life. I think we're close to the surface, said Nancy.
Yeah,
agreed Noob 11,988.
Definitely we are close to the surface. I can know that smell. It smells like something from another lifetime, but I know it.
The crack of light was now bigger and closer and gave enough light to illuminate the wrinkly, exhausted face and torso of Noob 11,988. The door was such that it was that European Space Agency mission specialist Nancy Gooding-McGinley and her newly acquired decrepit Jupiterian noob aide came to was large, wooden, covered in moss and seized shut. Nancy said the words, "Stand back, noob," and swung the axe at the once functioning door. It rewarded her with a thunk sound, but the light and structure stayed as before her strike. She knocked, pounded, thumped, hit, battered, and finally carefully jabbed with the pickaxe around the sliver of light, and eventually got tired, and laid the pickaxe in the ground, and sat down.
"Are you done?"
asked Noob 11,988.
"Yes,"
puffed Nancy.
"Are you sure you're done?"
asked Noob 11,988.
"Yeah."
"Do you mind if I have a go?"
asked Noob 11,988.
"No."
Nancy stood up to make way for Noob 11,988, who shuffled towards the barrier/door. He groaned with the effort of leaning over to grab the pickaxe. Nancy felt briefly guilty for not handing the tool to her elderly Jupiterian acquaintance, but reasoned that if the noob was foolish enough to want to have a swing, he might as well take all the associated discomfort. Noob 11,988 swung the pickaxe and wobbled forward with the effort. Nancy rolled her eyes and closed them. She heard a tap as the forged metal made contact with ancient wood. And then Noob 11,988 uttered the words,
"Hey, I recognise this place."
Nancy opened her eyes to see daylight streaming into the passage. The former door was scattered in a pile of moss-covered wood pieces outside the moss-covered frame that marked the boundary between the sunlight-free corkscrew cavern leading from the labyrinth of Chuntical to the surface of Jupiter. Beyond the moss-covered frame were shrubs and a gravel area of ground.
How is that possible, Noob 11,988? I mean, I'm an astronaut in the prime of my life, and you are, well, very elderly.
We have a saying here in Kuladof. The crossbow-equipped extraterrestrial explorer for the eye-rolling slouch of dismay, and the elderly tunnel-digging noob for the rigid doorway demolition.
That's very specific. Did you say this place is Kuladof?
It is, Nancy. I recognise the smell right away. It's a smell I haven't sniffed in many years. Digging the labyrinth of Chuntical may be torturous punishment, but the sanitation is excellent. Here in Kuladof, we just defecate at the edge of town. Or at least we used to when I lived here. We are, by the smell of it, at the entrance to the disused basilical mine. And by the smell of things, people still defecate here. Mind where you step.
Noob 11,988 stepped out from the cavern and onto the gravel that covered the ground immediately outside the entrance. Nancy stood up and followed. What she saw was a semicircle of gravel across the ground extending for about 10 metres to a covering of shrubs. The smashed remains of a heavy wooden door, a wooden frame set into a cave entrance at the bottom of a steep rocky slope, about 70 degrees, leading up into a hazy mist and mountains, and then a gravel-worn path leading through the shrubs and into a well-established woodland, and an assorted collection of feces of varying levels of vintage.
So you're from here, like a local? asked Nancy.
I used to be. Now I'm from the Labyrinth of Chunticle. Time is a bit of a blur in the labyrinth. I know lots of it has passed, and let me tell you, my body lets me know it too. But somehow this place seems to be the same.
Nancy, in an attempt to put a positive spin on their surroundings, said, It must be nice to be back.
It is,
said Noob 11988.
And cool it off only gets better from here,
he added. He then began walking the worn gravel path leading into the neatly managed forestry. Slowly. Nancy followed in his slow and shaky footsteps, which wasn't a very hard thing to do.
I well remember this place,
reminisced Noob 11988.
Back then I was known as Harry Seldon. If you had told me that in the future I'd be known as Noob 11988, I wouldn't have believed you. I suppose it's true what they say, the future is always unknown until it's the present. And then it's always slightly different than what you expected.
Nancy didn't reply. She was looking for some sort of landmark to get her bearings. The sky was blue, and they were heading towards the low sun, which meant they were going west, which did not really help at all.
I suppose anyone who remembers me will still know me as Harry Seldon, so it's probably better if I'm called that from now on.
Okay.
I suppose that means the future I imagined in the past is not really much different to this one, so...
Sure. Nancy and the newly renamed Harry Seldon followed the path through neatly managed forestry.
Ah, this takes me back,
noted Harry.
There's nothing like uniform rows of trees. Some people say trees should be let grow wild with their branches extending up to the stars. Not me, though. I like them straight, in decent, honest rows, 3 feet apart, and clipped. Where necessary.
Okay, replied Nancy. She'd been only half listening. Well, quarter listening would be more accurate. One quarter of mine was on the path and following Harry. The other half of her mind looked upwards, despite the bright sunlight, as she felt sure she could see stars. The quarter of Nancy's mind that had been watching the path noticed the trees growing more sparse and buildings start to appear. There were low single-story buildings at random scattered intervals, ranging from 10 feet to 100 metres or so. Some looked like dwellings, insomuch as they had small, low windows and chimneys and doors that faced onto the path, but most of them looked to be outbuildings or storage. Harry walked slowly over to the door of one of the apparent dwelling houses, pushed it open and stuck his head inside.
Nobody home,
he said.
This place is a lot quieter than I remember it.
Nancy and Harry passed about 10 more silent stone buildings. Then there were no more trees and the sloping path wound into a large open grassy area of ground. Hills sloped upwards all around. A river snaked through the open ground in front of them, leading to a large collection of buildings, large enough, in human terms, to qualify as a village.
Ah, that's where everyone is, said Harry.
The
that's where everyone is,
he was referring to, was a group of 80 or so humanoids gathered in a semicircle around a barrel wagon where the river met the collection of buildings. Harry walked straight towards him. Nancy followed, and they both covered a distance, eventually, to the group. Everyone in the group was seated, some on rough wooden chairs and some on boxes. But most were simply seated in the grass facing the barrel wagon and the collection of buildings slash village behind it.
That's awful, Dom Glomhosville,
said Harry, pointing to one of the seated humanoids.
Do you know, years haven't been good to him.
Harry walked over to a very old male humanoid who was sitting facing the wagon with his legs spread and his arms behind his back.
I never thought you'd get as old as what you have, awful dong,
said Harry.
Huh?
Asked the very old humanoid.
It's me, Harry Seldon, replied Harry. Speak up,
yelled the old humanoid.
It's me, Harry, Harry Seldon. No, Harry's been gone years. He insulted the Bongerlon. Said he was useless at Nangleball, and I think he was sent to Chunticle. I expect he's dead. No, I'm Harry Seldon, yelled Harry.
It was a loud enough yell to draw the attention of a dozen or so seated humanoids, and inspired them to shush in unison.
Harry? Harry? Harry Seldon? Is that you? Incredible. I knew I recognised your voice. No, you didn't,
disagreed Harry.
What's going on? I was full sure you'd be dead by now, Harry. How did you get free from the Labyrinth of Chunticle? I heard it was infinite. Is it? How come you look so young? That travelling show about the Dragon Blarden is in town.
Yell talked the elderly seated Offaldon.
I didn't die. I got out of the Labyrinth with the help of this extraterrestrial. I think it is infinite, but I've no way of really knowing. The food is good in there, and regular sleep and hard work has kept me fresh enough, although I've trouble with stairs. Are you telling me the Traveller Joe about the dragon Blarden is here today? Yes, it's about to start too. And you two arrived just in time. Oh, we did so well. We had a bit of trouble breaking out of the tunnel and it held us up. Turns out extraterrestrials are useless at breaking through old rotten wood. Who'd have thought? Anyways, we're here now, which is probably no harm because it was in the plot,
yelled Harry. The yell prompted an extremely lengthy and loud shh from most of the surrounding humanoids, which was concluded by someone saying,
"Will you shut up, you pair of old goats? The show is starting,"
in a slightly menacing tone. Just then, a Geronimus Flomp slumbered its way out of the front of the barrel-top caravan and flunked its way round to the side of the caravan facing the seated crowd. Nancy and Harry instinctively sat down. It was an instinct Nancy did not knowingly possess, but she found herself seated and waiting for something to happen. The place was unnaturally silent. Hobobulous splines shot out from the Geronimus Flomp. Each spline had an incalculable amount of peripheral tendrils, and each tendril splayed outwards. In an instant, the sky was filled with splines and tendrils and stars, and then it went dark, and only the stars were left. The Geronimus Flomp began speaking. Nancy listened. The words took her to an exposed rock clearing on the side of a low hill. The hillside was forested. It looked just like the forestry that had flanked the path that she had just walked with Harry, but there was something unnatural about the place she was in now. She wasn't really there. She was just observing. She found herself imagining a cub dragon with its mother. The dragon and mother were standing in the clearing and staring up at the stars. The mother was talking. "Myself and your father always came here," she said. "There is nowhere better to look at the stars on this planet." The cub nodded and stared up. Its nostrils flared and mouth fell open. "Not many people know that, but your father told me. And now you know too." The cub exhaled a small flame. The night air was cold and the flame quickly fizzled out. Its smoke drifted skywards.
I saw a shooting star. Is that Daddy?"
asked the cub. "No," replied his mother. "But he's up there. The shooting star is a sign sent by the gut to remind us of him."
I'm going to travel to the stars one day,"
said the cub. "I'm sure you will," said its mother. Nancy felt years passing. The cub was older, still closer to childhood than fully grown, but older. It was lying on a nest of elaborately woven fabric and listening. Two voices were arguing nearby.
"These opportunities come but once in a lifetime. There are dragons who live their lives without ever getting a chance like this."
But what about Blarden?"
came the second voice. It was the voice from the exposed rock clearing, the cub's mother. The tone was broken and angry.
I'm going. You two will want for nothing. Galactic Command pays well. Much better than the wages in this solar system. We're just going to catalogue some binary star systems. I'll be back within a planetary cycle."
The voices went silent.
"Blarden is young. He won't notice me gone."
Nancy felt more time passing. The mother and cub were back on the hilltop rock clearing, and the cub was older. They were both staring at a starry night sky.
"Where is he now?"
asked the cub.
"They call it Antares, Blarden," replied the mother. "I don't think we can see it from here. It's the furthest any dragon spacecraft has ever gone."
In an instant, Nancy was imagining herself back inside that same nest that the cub dragon had been lying in during the earlier argument, and standing next to the dragon called Blarden. He was older and looking out of a window down at the lights of a dragon transport which had stopped. There was nothing in Nancy's European Space Agency training that had described the customs and ways of dragons. But when Nancy saw the two uniformed, solemn-looking dragons exiting the transport, she knew it was not a warm or pleasant task they had to do. Blarden must have sensed that too, because he flinched and shuddered. The two uniformed dragons removed their hats as they approached below the window.
"There has been an accident, and no survivors. They did us all proud. We're very sorry."
The bearers of bad news are universally recognisable. The sombre and apologetic tones that spoke to Blarden's mother inspired wailing and caused Blarden to run to an exposed rock clearing on the side of a low hill. The hillside was forested. Blarden stared at the stars. They all flickered, and for one short moment Nancy was back sitting in the semicircle of about 80 or so Jupiterians listening as the Geronimus Flomp spoke. The very old former noob she now knew as Harry Seldon was sitting next to her. Everyone was silent. The Geronimus Flomp rapidly adjusted the peripheral tendrils at the end of its hobobulous splines, and Nancy found herself once more as an observer in the life of the dragon Blarden.
More time had passed, years and years. This time Nancy imagined Blarden in a uniform inside the control room of a spacecraft with about a dozen other uniformed dragons staring at a holographic map of the universe. Except for Blarden. He was speaking to one of the other dragons. Blarden and one of the other uniformed dragons looked to be agitated, and every one of the others carefully ignored the pair as they spoke.
But it's definitely our solar system. That blue planet is unique, and there is nothing else like it in the known universe.
That is no matter, Blarden. Even if I knew where we were, I could not tell you. You well know the exact route of an intergalactic traverse is known only to Central Command. What would happen if a crew on a decade-long hardship mission suddenly found out they were passing their home, huh?
Blarden was silent as the other dragon spoke. Every other creature in the room was silent too, but each one was listening. A red dot blinked and passed close to a single star with 9 orbiting planets on the holographic map of the universe. One of the planets was unmistakably blue and caused that single star system to stand out among the dozen or so others visible on the hologram.
What would happen, Commander, is that they would want to go home, which is what we want to do now. We've already done 2 traverses. It's enough. And the crew have had enough. We're going home.
The dragon Blarden had been speaking to began a slow walk around the room and started speaking louder so the entire room could hear.
So that's it then, ha! A mutiny! And each one of ye too scared to admit it, so ye got that simpleton Blarden to speak up for ye.
The room stayed silent apart from some indistinguishable automated commands and beeps coming from the control panels and screens on the walls of the room. The red dot was moving to the single star and its 9 orbiting planets.
Ye all well know that the opportunity to serve with mapping command only comes once in a lifetime. There are no second chances. And you can all be sure that the crew who mutiny on board a dragon spacecraft during an intergalactic traverse will go down in history as a symbol of morally bankrupt cowardice. And that will be your legacy. It is every dragon's duty to reach for the stars. And if you are not prepared to do it willingly, I will make force you will do it unwillingly.
Of the 13 dragons that had listened to the speech, only Blarden responded.
You cannot do that, Commander. You're only one dragon and the rest of us want to go home. We've already set a course, and as soon as we intersect Jupiterian gravity, this spacecraft is going to drop from the traverse.
It is in my scaly, sun-deprived hole going to drop from the transect. We have a mission to complete, and I'm going to make sure we all complete it, even if it means killing us all.
The dragon Blarden had been referring to as Commander then unleashed a fiery torrent from his mouth. In an instant, the control room was drenched in flame. Several of the other dragons collapsed to the floor, their scales and uniforms a blaze of yellow and blue. The fire-breathing commanding dragon then moved slowly to the centre of the room, spraying fire as he moved. Every panel and display on the walls of the room blinked and chimed an alert. A sprinkler system soaked the room, but it was no match for the flame. The dragons who had not already succumbed to the flame began to spit flame back. Blarden ducked into the one corner of the room that was not completely ablaze and attempted to operate the controls. Smoke was everywhere. Nancy watched in silence from her universe apart audience viewpoint and saw. Fleeting images of dragons striking and tearing at each other. Their movement was fast and brutal and the flames intense. One by one the dragons fought and died until there was only 2 left breathing. One was the dragon Blarden had referred to as the Commander. He was injured, wheezing, and lying in the middle of the control room, apparently unable to stand. The other was Blarden.
Is that you in the corner, Blarden? How does it look?
All systems down. We've lost propulsion. Life support is failing. And we're caught in the gravitational pull of the largest planet. There are 4 large moons, but it looks like we'll miss them.
All systems down?
Yes, no propulsion to slow a planetary descent or life support. Hard to tell which will happen first. Asphyxiation or burning up when gravity pulls us into the planet's atmosphere.
The largest planet? Jupiter?
Yes.
Well, well, well. You got what you wanted, Blarden. You're going home.
Nancy watched in silence. Time, which had once passed rapidly, was now passing very slowly. The years of Blarden's life had gone by in a flash, and now the seconds were creeping by. The injured commanding dragon spoke again.
I envy you, Blarden. You know that.
Blarden did not respond to the injured dragon.
You have a family. A son. A pregnant wife. A home. Your life has been well lived.
Blarden continued to ignore the injured dragon.
Is it okay if I keep talking to you, Blarden? I know you hate me, but I'm dying. and I don't want to die in silence.
Blardin didn't answer.
Every sacrifice, continued the injured commanding dragon. Every year of struggle, every star system catalogued, every galaxy mapped, everything I've spent my whole life doing, everything will die with this spacecraft.
Blardin said nothing.
I envy you, Blardin. You can blame me for this, and you might be right, but it is in the nature of dragons to reach for the stars. And you have your memories. Memories of a family. Of a life on Jupiter. And at least you have those. Yes, I envy you, Blardin. Because this ship, this mission, this command, that is all I have ever really had. And now it is all destroyed. I envy you, Blardin.
You are wrong, Commander. I don't blame you for this. And my life has not been well lived. I had a life, a home, a family. But I turned my mind to the stars, to this mission. And now I don't even know my own son. I left my pregnant wife to do this, to be here. For what? To realise how precious all that was. How short a time we all really have. And how it can all be taken away in an instant. Blardin stared at the display on the panel next to him. We're entering the atmosphere now, Commander. Commander? Blardin glanced back at the crumpled hide of the dragon he called Commander. You were only half right, Commander, he said. I am going home, but it is not what I wanted. Nancy found herself imagining a brilliant flash of light, and then an exposed rock clearing on the side of a hill. The hillside was forested. She saw a cub dragon with its mother. The dragon and mother were standing in the clearing and staring up at the stars. The mother was talking. Myself and your father always used to come here, you know, she said. There is nowhere better to look at the stars on this planet. The cub nodded and stared up. Its nostrils flared and mouth fell open. Not many people know that, but your father told me. And now you know too. The cub exhaled a small flame. The night air was cold and the flame quickly fizzled out. Its smoke drifted upwards.
I saw a shooting star. Is that Blardin?
Asked the cub. No, replied his mother. But he's up there. The shooting star is a sign sent by the gut to remind us of him.
I'm going to travel to the stars one day, said the cub.
I'm sure you will, said his mother.
The Geronimus Flomp retracted the tendrils from its hobobulous splines and then retracted its hobobulous splines. It harrumphed, walked slowly to the front of the barrel top caravan and climbed back inside. The story was over.
That, said someone, was a bag of shite.
Almost everyone seemed to agree.
Yeah, a bag of shite. Big old bag of shite.
What? Asked Nancy.
Bag of shite, replied someone beside her. Oh, I thought it was very moving,
noted Harry.
What does a bag of shite on Jupiter mean, Harry? Asked Nancy in a very loud voice.
Bag of shite? Never heard of it, replied Harry. Hey, what does Ophelon, Ophelon, what does bag of shite mean? Huh?
Replied Ophelon Glumhostevule.
What does bag of shite mean?
Said Harry in an even louder voice.
Not sure, but it must be good because Chancellor Staunton uses the saying, and he's Sosmond Borkstapple's right-hand man.
Chancellor Staunton? Sosmond Borkstapple? Remarked asked Nancy.
Bag of shite? Remarked asked Harry. It's going to take me a while to catch up with the new sayings around here.
Have any of you, anybody, has anyone here met Chancellor Staunton?
Asked Nancy. She asked loudly and urgently. Urgently enough for someone nearby to say,
How would we have? He's only just arrived on Jupiter, and already he is Sosmond's most trusted advisor. There's no way anyone called off would be allowed to speak to him. You mustn't be from round here.
I'm not, said Nancy.
She's an extraterrestrial from the European Space Agency,
offered Harry.
Is that in outer space?
Asked someone.
Of course it is, replied Harry. Does she know Chancellor Staunton? Don't be stupid. Outer space is a big place. You can't expect her to know everyone.
It sounds like she knows him.
I think I do, said Nancy.
And that was it for the mid-morning on the fourth day of the first crewed human mission to another planet. A newly appointed Jupiterian Chancellor, European Space Agency Mission Specialist Bart McMorrow on top of a Spontaniger transportation robot on the Sea of Uncertainty, a newly formed subterranean army of sorts, a newly renamed Harry Seldon, and a Geronimus Flomp.
Right, that was a long one. Thanks if you stuck with it. I hope you stuck with it, and I appreciate it if you did. There'll be more next week or the week after in Chapter 27. And don't forget, if you are tooling around the internet and looking for stuff to listen to, check out Madison on the Air. It's a great show and well worth checking out. And they have a new episode coming up on the 1st of December.